Mickey Burns has profiled hundreds of athletes and celebrities on his hit TV show Profiles on NYC Media Network's Channel 25 over the past decade and a half. The West Brighton resident has been privileged enough to sit across from the likes of legends such as Joe Montana, Smokey Robinson, George Foreman, and many, many more. He's put it down in a fascinating memoir. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from Staten Island, no less, the man himself, Mickey Burns. Mickey, good afternoon. From me, good morning to you.
Hey, Giles, pleasure to be on your show and welcome to New York City.
I tell you one thing, it's a little bit, when normally I interview people and it's, you know, you sit there and you go, yeah, I'm going to, you know, shoot the proverbial with them for 20 minutes or so. It won't be a problem because they know a little about what I'm doing. And then I get you, my friend, a man who has been doing this job for the best part of, a decade and a bit, really, isn't it?
It's about two decades we've been doing the show. Matter of fact, Giles, we just celebrated our 500th episode in January.
Congratulations.
So it's been a long ride. It's been a long ride, and we continue to do it, even though we're coping with the pandemic like everyone else.
So are you in lockdown in Staten Island? Is that why, where you're broadcasting from at the moment?
Well, yeah, I'm calling from my home, but currently we're not really on lockdown any longer. As a matter of fact, we started doing our studio interviews again this week. So New York City is faring very well with the pandemic, better than most of the country at this point.
And for those who aren't familiar with your shows, just give me an outline of what your show comprises of.
Well, you know, I can give you an overview of how it began. I was doing another show for Time Warner at the Time Warner Cable called Special Edition. And in every episode, we would have like a 4-minute celebrity profile. And I used to go back to the studio all the time and said, I just interviewed Tony Orlando on Broadway. And I came back with like a 30-minute dynamite interview, but we can only use 4 minutes of it. I said, we should do a long form overview of celebrities' lives and careers, call it profiles. And let's see how it goes. And we started doing it, I believe in 2000 or 1999. And right from the start, it was a hit because there's not a lot of shows left that do long-form interviews with celebrities. You know, it's almost like if you're on Jimmy Fallon, it's like a 5-minute interview. How's the new movie? How's your wife? And adios. With us, we have a half hour to talk about the keys to the success of the celebrity, his passions, and his career. So that's how Profiles began, and now we're basically easily in 20 years.
And isn't that a great thing? Because, you know, we live in an era, and, you know, we've been lucky enough to work in this business for a period of time now. We've seen it change, but not always for the better. And now from a show like Profiles, which gives time and like a slow burn cooker, you know, allows you to know the personality behind the image a little bit. And yet, right, we live in an era where it's all Instagram, immediate fight. You just said the Jimmy Fallon thing. Hi, what are you pushing? How's the wife? Adios. And to actually to get to know people, and to find, because people have interesting backstories, and in a media image where it's, you know, people have got the attention span of a gnat, it's great to have something you can get your teeth into.
Yes, that's true, and also the accessibility of the celebrities that we've had on Profiles over the years. Being in New York, we do the show from Times Square, and that helps because a celebrity that's pushing a book, a new CD, a new TV series, they can actually do our show, the Today Show, Sirius Radio. We're all in like a 5-block radius. So that's been a tremendous asset for the elevation of the show.
Did the celebrities themselves enjoy speaking a little bit more than just having to churn out the same? Because when they're on that film or that record, or that, I said record, that download it probably is now, treadmill, it's like, you know, they wheel a journalist in, he asks the same questions, they get wheeled out, the hotel door opens, they get wheeled in again, the same questions, out again. It must be quite a thing for them to actually sit down with somebody and develop a rapport with the subject.
Well, that's a good question, Giles. And I think, you know, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. I mean, that's the slogan. How do you become a good radio or TV interviewer? And I always say the key is research, research, research. And when I have Smokey Robinson or Christopher Plummer or Dr. Maya Angelou or George Foreman, my people give me a packet. I do my that has all the background of the celebrity, and then I start digging for information that people may not be aware of. I spend about 10 hours. Because if they have a book, I read it. If they have a CD, I listen to it. If they have a trailer, I watch it. So I do a lot of research, and I'm very prepared when the interview takes place. And the celebrities all respect and appreciate that. And I can tell you a quick story if you have a moment.
Who's got a moment for you, my friend?
Yeah, and Christopher Plummer, he won an Academy, the oldest person who won an Academy Award at like 88 years old. The week before I had him on my show, my assistant handed me the packet, and she said, there's a radio interview at the very top. You should listen to that before you go any further. And I did. And the radio interview was from Ohio, and it was a radio interview with Christopher Plummer. And it started out like, Christopher Plummer, welcome to WKRP in Cincinnati. Welcome to my show. And the interviewer, the host, asked Christopher about three questions that had nothing to do with his autobiography, the reason he was on the show. And he stopped the interviewer right in his tracks and said, excuse me, son, did you read my book? And the interviewer in his best Jackie Gleason said, humada, 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 I haven't yet, but I'm going to. And with that, all you hear is a click. Christopher Plummer hung up on him. So, you know, if you don't do your research, that's not going to be well received nor respected.
What's it like when you sit down in front of somebody and you know they've got a body of work in front of them, like a Christopher Plummer or a Smokey Robinson, and the temptation to come, does the professionalism kick in there? Because it must be difficult not to come off sometimes as a bit of a fanboy as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a fan a lot. I mean, Smokey Robinson, I was a big fan of for many years, and his music. You know, but I'll tell you another tip, Giles. Before the interview, I had read, like myself, we're both avid golfers. And you know, whatever I can do to kind of break the ice and bond with these celebrities prior to the interview makes for a better interview. So with the crew and I got together, we purchased a putter to help him with his putting. He was struggling a little bit, right? So before the interview, I gave him the putter. He said, my God, Mickey, I've been in this business 50 years. Nobody ever, I'm lucky to get a cup of coffee. So now, you know, his publicist, who was sitting right there, told me weeks ahead of time, you have 25 minutes, not a minute more, because we have several interviews today. Well, as we were getting to the 23-minute mark, I saw the assistant out of the corner of my eye trying to get me to close the interview. But Smokey saw it as well. And he turned to his assistant and said, his name was Tony. And he said, Tony, sit down. I'm talking to my brother, Mickey. I'll tell you when we're done. So see, would it be a nice gesture? Got me. And we ended up doing a 45-minute interview. We made two episodes out of it, and both episodes won Telly Awards.
Isn't it great, though, when you do that? Because the bane of many interviewers is the assistant or the PR person who, you know, infrequently says, now, you cannot go off message. You have to toe the line. Yep. You have to talk about that subject.
Yep. Many of them are like that. But what I find is if they realize that you're not there to hurt them, you're not there to hurt the celebrity, they'll allow you larger parameters as you get into the interview and to go off course. As long as it's a positive, uplifting kind of interview. Once they realize you're not trying to hurt them, everything changes.
Mickey, that's an interesting point, because again, in a business now that is dominated by sensationalism, by instant headlines, and you say you're not trying to hurt them, because it is so easy for somebody trying to make a name and new to the game to go in with a line of questioning that makes somebody look stupid.
Yep, and that's what most people want to do today. You know, and I have, you know, I try to bond with the celebrity. I have 10 minutes with them prior to the interview. And I always meet with them in that 10 minutes in the green room. And it's funny, Giles, because they always say, you know, what are we going to talk about? You know, they want to pick your brain so they're prepared. And I don't want to do that because I don't want them to be affected and rehearsed. So what I do in that 10 minutes, I want to know is, what's your hobby? What do you like to do when you're not working? Tell me about your family. You have any pets? You know, what do you like? Where do you like to go on vacation? And I'll talk about anything but what the interview is going to be about. And then once you sit down for the interview, you almost feel like you know each other a little bit.
Much, much easier. Now, I did a little bit of research, nothing like reading the book or anything like that, unfortunately, because it hasn't reached me yet. So please don't put the phone down, a la Christopher Plummer. But I was intrigued to see that when you...
I'm going to send you the book.
I'd look forward to reading it. I'll pick up a few pointers. Anyway, sport has played a very big part in your life. Tell me a little bit about, you know, because you have always been a New York boy.
Yeah, my book is called From the Projects, the Profiles, a Memoir. Because I grew up in the South Beach Projects, and my parents, my father was in World War II, and when he came back after the war, he was like 30 years old with very little education. So to get out of the projects economically was the goal of most of the residents there. And I realized that athletics was going to be my ticket out early on. And I would say to my mother, how do you feel about me going to college? And she would always say, that would be wonderful, but you're going to have to figure out a way to get a scholarship. Back in the day. And I did through athletics. I went to Missouri Valley College on a football scholarship. And that was really my ticket and my future. I never looked back.
And it really was a case of you know, getting in from school and then throwing on your sports clothes and going to, I got this wonderful image of you just like dashing home and then flinging on whatever you used to go in training in. And just, there would be kids playing in the park or there'd be games going on in the local parks and sports grounds, which I don't know. I mean, does that sort of situation still exist over there?
You know, there's a scene in the Titanic where Rose looks back on the Titanic many years after it sunk to the bottom of the sea in all its glory, and she's dreaming about it. Well, it was the same thing. I went back to the projects recently, and of course, when I grew up there, as I mentioned in the book, we would run home from school, change into our play clothes, run down to the park and play whatever the sport of the season was with 40 or 50 other kids. And if you didn't get to the park fast enough, you waited on the side until your turn came to get in the game. I went there recently and there's nobody there. It's barren. There's not one kid playing outside in the park. I assume maybe it's a safety factor, you know, that, the parents don't feel the kids are safe there. I don't know. Or they're playing computer games, but they're not outside participating in sports like we did back in the day.
And I mean, there was baseball, basketball, and American football, as we Europeans would call it, and it was baseball that was your big thing, was it?
Well, football was my big thing.
Okay,
my big thing because I mean, I played baseball. I went on both a baseball and football scholarship to college, but you know, football I felt was my the best of all the sports. And when I graduated, interesting story, Giles, when I got out of college, I was so driven to get an education because I knew what an opportunity was in front of me. And I wanted to go right to graduate school. And when I graduated my senior year, I got a letter from Vince Lombardi. He was the coach of the Green Bay Packers. And in 1970, that was his first year as the head coach of Washington Redskins. And he wrote me a beautiful letter inviting me to camp in the summer. And I said, you know, but I didn't go, Giles. And the reason was back then there wasn't a lot of money in pro football. You know, that was not your driving motivation like it is today. Today you make millions.
Yeah.
If you're in the NFL. Then, you know, I would say the players were making $60,000, $70,000. That was about it. Other than Joe Namath and people like that. So I wrote him a letter back and said, you know, thank you for the invitation. And I hadn't got hurt. I played 4 years in high school, 4 years in college, and I never had a serious injury. And it was almost like I said, I think I better quit while I'm ahead. So I wrote him a beautiful letter. I continued my education. I got my master's degree that year and came back to New York City, and I was ready for bear, so to speak.
We'll leave the football, but there's a wonderful story that I picked up on about the what's been described as the Staten Island version of the Super Bowl. Where is it true that you couldn't afford new boots or something, so you taped your old ones together?
Wow, you did your research, Giles. I'm impressed. Well, I was in my senior year. Of course, I was trying to get a college scholarship. That was the first thing, And in our big game on Thanksgiving Day, it was the last game of the season, my shoe, you have one pair of spikes for the season. They're football spikes. And they were starting, the sole was ripping away from the body of the shoe. And I said, geez, how am I going to play this game with this shoe? And it didn't even dawn on me to go to my parents, who had no money, and say, you know, Mom and Dad, I need a new pair of shoes for one game. Mind you, Giles, I was in the running for the city scoring championship. And scholarships were in the bargain, you know? Yeah. So what we decided to do, the trainer said, Mickey, that's no problem. So they taped it, you know, but they taped it so that the shoe was almost like part of my foot. You know what I'm saying? And so it was fine. And I got through the game. I scored 2 touchdowns. I won the city scoring championship, and I got my scholarship.
Congratulations. I just think that's just a wonderful image. The move from sport, or from what you were doing then, tell me about how you got your foot in the door into broadcasting. And you mentioned that when you got when you first went into a studio, you kind of knew that you belonged there.
Oh, yeah. Something I always wanted to do. I studied communications in college. But when I got out, it was BC, which stands for before cable. I always called BC.
Right.
And there were different, you know, jobs were scarce because you didn't have 500 channel universe. You had ABC, CBS, NBC. That was pretty much it. So the jobs were minimal. So I decided to come back to New York and go into teaching. Some years later, friends of mine that I grew up with were cameramen, videographers at Fox News. And they said, Mickey, because I also had love of music, so I knew sound equipment. And they said to me, Mickey, why don't you come up to my partner's going on vacation, and you could come and sub for him. And the first day, Giles, I said, man, what have I been missing? Because the first thing they sent us on was, and I was just doing the sound, I was with a reporter and a videographer, go to City Hall, and the mayor was giving a press conference. We did that. After that was over, they said, go up to Yankee Stadium, go on the field, and get sound bites with the players. And it was one of the best days I've had in years. I said, what a way to make a living. I was hooked. So some years later, I worked my way to get in front of the camera when we started to do a news magazine called Special Edition. But in the meantime, while I was there as a sound man, I was learning everything I could from the best in the business. And I was a sponge for about a year or two before I got my opportunity. But I was ready when it came.
How important do you think was the cable explosion to independent TV and shows like you ended up doing and have been doing since?
Well, I think it became an unlimited opportunity. I mean, if you have any talent at all, you should be able to find your niche somewhere. You know, I mean, if I was in my 20s, I would probably want to work at the Golf Channel. Because I love golf, and I would love what a life where you're covering the sport and playing and being around that. Whatever your interest, whether it be food, travel, entertainment, there's opportunity everywhere. There was very little opportunity when I first started.
And were you sort of, did you surprise yourself when you sort of found yourself, you know, behind the mic interviewing people like Henry Winkler or Meatloaf? Was it something you just felt, well, you know, do you sort of still pinch yourself and think, you know, how did I get here?
Yeah, that's another good question. But I think because of my background, I was always in entertainment of some sort. You know, when you're playing football in front of 10,000, 20,000 people, it's kind of similar to being in front of a microphone interviewing Meatloaf. You know, you're on. You've got to be at your best. You don't want to embarrass yourself. So being in pressure situations was something that I've been in since I was a teenager. So when I started interviewing celebrities, I felt very comfortable from the beginning. And I realized, you know, they're all human just like us, you know, so I wasn't really like a star-struck type of a personality. And, you know, I was comfortable from day one. And I realized also, Giles, and I mentioned it prior, the research has a, if you're prepared, really prepared, you'll be fine in almost every situation. Because I've interviewed Dr. Maya Angelou. I've interviewed Deepak Chopra. They're intellectuals. And in many cases, I feel going in, you say, oh, man, am I over my head in this interview? But if you're really prepared, they'll recognize that, and they'll give you a good interview.
Comfortable. One of the things that they always say is you should always be very sort of wary about meeting your heroes, because when you get to meet somebody you've idolized from a long way away, they can be completely different to how you've imagined them in your head. You've met many of your heroes. Which ones came up to the mark?
Well, you know, Tom Jones was somebody who I loved him because of his tremendous talent, you know. And then when I met him, he's actually very shy in person. So I was a little surprised there. Engelbert Humperdinck, I don't know if you, do you know?
Oh, yes, yes, we know Engelbert. Don't worry about that.
He was such a nice guy. Surprised me that he was his personality was so charming and giving, you know. Can I tell you an Engelbert Humperdinck story?
Please do, absolutely.
Because I had read somewhere that he in one of his autobiographies or books he had written that he had made love to over 2,000 women.
Not at the same time, we hope.
Yes. And I asked him, is that accurate?
Right.
2,000 women. I said, wow. And I didn't know if I should ask that question, but the interview was going so well. I said, let me go for it.
Yeah.
So I said, is it accurate you made love to? And he laughed and he looked at me, didn't hesitate. He said, Mickey, less work for my wife.
Now, you see, if you can get a subject to say that to you, then you've cracked it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we bonded as well. But he bonds with everybody. He's such a charming guy.
So what was it? What made you? Was it the fact that you'd passed this master and you decided you're going to sit down and do this book, do this memoir? And what was the aim? Because it wasn't just simply to say, oh, look, here's all the great people I've had to hang out with and take pictures with. There has to be a reason and a purpose behind it, surely.
Right. I think the message in the book is to inspire other people, you know, that no matter where they come from, either physically or economically, you know, that if they work hard, they can make their dreams come true, like I did. And I think that's the underlying message of the book.
I know it's a thing, but can you pick out? I mean, apart from Tom Jones is a favorite, Engelbert's unpredicted favorite. Out of the sport, because you know you did sports, you must have interviewed some sports people that made you think, great to sort of share some time with them.
Oh yeah, I mean, when I had Joe Montana, he was a 4-time Super Bowl champ. I couldn't believe I was sitting across from him. You know, I said, this guy, he's one of the greatest players in football NFL history. But unfortunately, there was a story to that too, because when we did him in his hotel room, he was at a sports memorabilia conference, and we set up the lights and the cameras. There was also a nice spread of cold cuts and sandwiches. And I said, that was really nice of these guys to set us up for that before the interview.
Yeah.
So then Joe walks in for the interview with his manager. The manager calls me over. And he's got this stern look on his face. He looks at me and says, Mickey, who ate Joe's dinner? and I said, I thought it was for us.
Oh, no.
So I started off my Joe Montana interview by saying, Joe, I'm so sorry I ate your dinner. He said, Mickey, don't worry about it. I wouldn't eat that garbage. I'm going out to a nice Italian restaurant after this interview. So he let us off the hook. George Foreman was phenomenal. You know, George Foreman, heavyweight champ of the world, but also exceptionally successful in business.
Yeah.
You know? And he said to me something. I always leave with something from every one of these guests. And he said to me, Mickey, a good business deal isn't a good one unless both parties are happy.
Fair enough. That's good. One of the things I wanted to, because you introduced George Foreman, you know, and smoking, you know, and the thing that with box, I mean, sports personalities, they, you know, they live in a very cloistered background. You know, they can be quite interesting to interview, but especially boxers, because that is a mindset that is quite rare. And if you don't get on with a boxer, they let you know quite quickly.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, George is such a charming guy. You know, but he went from being very mean and nasty. He even said during the interview that his goal in life was to kill one of his opponents in the ring. He said, then they'll really be afraid of me. Right?
Yeah.
He went from that to being a pastor and very religious driven. And I'm telling you, he nicest guy in the world, but he wasn't that way in the beginning.
And let's just remind ourselves that if you'd eaten George's lunch, he could have cooked you one freshly, because he was obviously well known for his grill as well.
Yes, yes. Well, he mentioned that with the grill. He said when they first approached him, they said, George, what do you want? And he didn't know they meant money. He says, you know, I have seven sons named George. Can I have seven grills for my kids? He didn't know there was money involved.
You've also interviewed two British icons, the great Joan Collins, actress, and Adam Ant, who I've seen a picture of you with. Must have been interesting experiences on both sides.
Yeah, and who was the first one? Adam Ant was great. He looked like Johnny Depp when I interviewed him.
He was Johnny Depp before Johnny Depp was Johnny Depp.
Yes. And who was the first one?
Joan Collins.
Joan Collins was amazing. You know, she must have been in her 60s when I interviewed her, and she was still gorgeous. And we talked about her appearance. She was on one of the early Star Trek episodes. And I had found something she was so impressed with that she was struggling with her acting career, I guess, before Dynasty. And she went and somebody said to her, Joan, while you're struggling, you're eligible for unemployment. And she went to the unemployment office with a bunch of lines of people there with one of her gowns, like from Dynasty.
Right.
And she made such a fuss. And she said, Nikki, how did you find that information? She said, yeah, I made a mistake. I shouldn't have wore a gown to the unemployment office.
Yeah. Probably not.
But she got her unemployment.
Probably not the best of moves. What do you hope? So you said you hope that people take out, that you can do anything you really put your mind to from the book.
Who are some of the people that have done that?
Yeah, I mean, no, I mean, I said, the thing you want to get from this book is that people can realize their dreams. Yourself, you know, a kid from the projects, now celebrating over 20 years.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's the underlying message. But also from my 25 plus years in broadcasting, I give a lot of tips on how to be a better interviewer, you know, and how to do it right. I mean, I learned from the best. But I watch a lot of the Zoom interviews today, and I was talking to somebody the other night. A lot of interviewers make the same mistake. You know, and that mistake during the interview is they talk about themselves a lot. They interject their own personal experiences. And I always say nobody really cares. You know, what they want to hear about is the person that's being interviewed, right?
Absolutely.
If I'm interviewing Joe Montana, they don't want to hear that I watched him play at Meadowlands when he scored two touchdowns. They want to hear about his life and career.
The book is called Mickey Burns, From the Projects to the Profiles, a memoir. It's out now. Mickey, if people wanted to get in touch with you or find out more about you, it is available as a download from our virtual bookstore, just so you know, so you have some European fans. But how can they find it? Do you do the social media thing? Is there a website?
Yeah, I'm everywhere. You know, I'm on Facebook, Mickey Burns TV, Instagram, Mickey Burns TV, a website, Profiles TV Show. You can go to NYC Media. That's the network that we're on here in New York City, and go to their website and watch 15 or 20 of the most recent episodes in their entirety. So I'm easy to find on Google, Mickey Burns, and we're ready to go. I also have a second book coming out. It'll be out in November, and it's called Inside Celebrity Profiles, A Visual Journey. And it's all photographs of our 500 episodes.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I've had so much fun doing this one that I think I'll have to get you back for the second one. Can I only leave you with two final questions, which is,
sure.
What are your hobbies, and have you got any pets? Because that's what you always ask your interviewers before you come on.
Right. But that's two good questions. My hobby is golf. I've been playing with the same golfers. We've stayed together for decades. And I have a real passion for it. That's my exercise and my mental escape is golf. And the second question was?
The pets. Do you have any pets?
I had a pet. I had a dog for 17 years. His name was Big Shot. That's what I call him. And when he passed, I realized, you know, my kids are gone. There's nobody home. A lot of times I'm very busy. I hate to leave dogs in the house by themselves. I don't think it's a healthy condition. So I really haven't gotten one since I lost Big Shot.
Well, that's, you know, pretty good, pretty wise thing to do. And who is your next interview? Just leave you with that. Who's your next profile?
Well, my next profile is going to be Howard Bloom. I don't know if you know Howard Bloom, but he was the legendary publicist who enhanced and sustained careers for Michael Jackson, Bob Marley, Billy Joel, Bette Midler, and the list goes on and on.
Wow.
The Bloom Organization was the biggest music publicity firm in the country for the definitely late 70s and all of the 80s. So I'm going to interview him on how he became so successful.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today. The book is called From the Project to Profiles and Memoir. It's by Mickey Burns. Mickey, thank you so much for your time today.
Giles, it was a great experience. You did you're a wonderful interviewer, and continued success to you.
Thank you very much.